To Matthew chapter 17. And we'll try to finish out this chapter. Father, I pray that as we again meditate together on your word, that you would help us to grow in our faith. I pray that you would speak to us of the specific ways that you would have us apply these things, as we recognize it could be different in different ones of our lives. I pray that you would give me strength and the mind and ability to teach your word this morning. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. There's a Christmas carol that was, the words of which were written by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. I heard the bells on Christmas Day. And that, as I approach this chapter, this section of Scripture from verse 22 to the end of Matthew 17. One of the verses in there seems to describe kind of what Jesus' disciples may have felt, what I often feel myself. Where he says, "And in despair I bowed my head, there is no peace on earth. I said, for hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth. Goodwill to men." This was, of course, it was written at the peak of the war between the states by a northerner who was assessing things and thinking, it looks like the South is going to win. This feels unjust. Is there going to be peace on earth? His son had been injured in the war a year before he wrote it. His wife, his second wife, had died in a tragic accident, with him looking on and trying to rescue her. There's a lot of pain in his life and a lot of questions he was asking as he wrote that those words. But sadly, Longfellow was not a believer in the deity of Christ. He was not a believer that he didn't believe that Jesus died to save us from our sin. Even though he had a lot of Christian culture in his life. And so his Unitarian faith could not ultimately help him. But I believe our faith can help us when we face suffering, when we face uncertainty. How does a Christian respond when we have suffered loss or injustice? I want to look at these two stories from the life of Christ at the close of Matthew 17 here that point us towards three Christian responses to injustice. And I'll just kind of say up front so you can see the roadmap. The three Christian responses that I see outlined in these stories is grief. That's a Christian response. Suffering, choosing to suffer, is another Christian response. And faith, trusting God in the midst of suffering. So I want to look at these things. Starting at verse 22, says, "Then as they were returning into Galilee, Jesus said to them, 'The Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him. Yet, during the third day, he will be resurrected.' And they were very grieved." Here, I've stepped out on a limb with my translation by saying, "as they are returning into Galilee," King James, and the traditional interpretation is they were living or staying in, abiding in Galilee. The modern English editions of our Bible say, as they were coming together, gathering up. But I'll explain what I'm. My understanding as I'm reading this, and I forgot to bring a map down, but if you can imagine a map of Israel here, you got the Mediterranean Sea here, and the land of Israel here, Egypt down below, and Lebanon, Syria up above. So right up at the northern border, you've got Mount Hermon. That's where, I think, the Transfiguration happened. And right at the base of Mount Hermon is a town called Caesarea Philippi, which is in a different state from Galilee or Judea. It was ruled by a different ruler, Philip. That's why it's called Philippi. And that's where Jesus had his retreat with his disciples before he went up to the Transfiguration. He came back down the mountain. I think that's was in, at the foot of the mountain there in Caesarea Philippi that he healed the boy of the lunatic boy of his the evil spirit. And so then they're coming down south back into Galilee, and at some point you're going to cross over from Trachonitis into Galilee, and then as they keep going south, they'll hit Capernaum at the top of the Sea of Galilee. Does that make sense? So they're making their way back down to Capernaum, where Jesus' family household was, and Peter's house was also there in Capernaum. So in Galilee, as they're on their way back from this trip up to Caesarea Philippi, Jesus makes this statement, and he reiterates what he's just told his disciples at the beginning of their retreat in Caesarea Philippi. Remember, he said in chapter 16, verse 21, he began to show his disciples that it was necessary for him to go away into Jerusalem and to suffer many things from the elders and high priests and scribes, and to be killed and to be resurrected during the third day. The second reminder now that we're seeing in chapter 17, verse 22, contains only one new piece of information since the statement he made in chapter 16, and that is that he would be betrayed or delivered. The same Greek word is translated either way, betrayed or delivered over to the power of these men, and that he would be killed as a result of that. Now, I hope we all know that Jesus would not be delivered over because he was powerless. He was, some kind of a helpless pawn before the Roman and Jewish governments there. Romans 8:32 tells us that it was God himself that delivered Jesus over to the power of men before men ever started delivering him or betraying him. Romans 8:32 says, "He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for all of us, how will he not also with him freely give us all things?" So Jesus was the only way he could be delivered to the hands of men was that God had first delivered him to that, and he was delivering himself. But think about it. Judas was standing there as Jesus said this. The Son of Man will be betrayed or delivered into the hands of men. Judas, the one who would do it, who would be the betrayer, the one who delivered him into the hands of the Jewish leaders, who would then deliver him into the hands of the Roman leaders and crucify him. Judas was standing right there. Now, Jesus could well have been giving his disciples a cue here that from here on out he was not going to be doing as much stepping back and letting things cool down as he had been earlier in his ministry. We see a number of times in his early ministry he things get hot, he steps away. Now in this later part of his ministry, he's going to keep the pressing forward, and it's going to allow things to escalate, which leads to his death. which the whole thing is intentional on Jesus' part, because it was his purpose to die for our sins. But the responses of both Jesus and his disciples to the injustice that he's predicting and that actually occurred, the injustice of him being killed as a criminal, the responses to that give us, I think they demonstrate to us some ways that we can respond to injustice ourselves appropriately and in a Christian manner. The first one is, we see in that verse 23, they were very grieved. The disciples grieved, and grief is an appropriate response to injustice. We're not told that the disciples understood everything Jesus was saying, but it was enough, you know, to give them the idea that something bad's going to happen to Jesus, and that makes us sad. It's entirely like that, and that, you know, that's based on their love for Jesus. They loved him. They didn't want to see him die. Yes, it was mixed with mistaken ideas and you know, sinful selfishness and you know, but who of us doesn't have that problem of having this mixture of genuine love and selfish and wrong-headed ideas as we conduct our lives? It was fine for them to grieve. Other godly people in the Bible have grieved and set an example for us. In 1 Samuel 30, when David came back from his military campaign with the Philistines and finds that the Amalekites had just demolished his city and captured his wife and children, he grieved. He wept, the Bible tells us. That was appropriate. It demonstrates to the world that this was wrong. This was unjust. When Lazarus dies, Jesus wept. It shows that death is not a good thing. It's a tragedy that has come as a result of sin. It was appropriate to weep over that. It's entirely appropriate to let our face fall in sorrow when evil things happen, like the shooting at the Sandy Hook Elementary School this week, or the armed pillaging of the church in Yemen this week. It's entirely appropriate to mourn, to show grief. I've heard about this movement of encouraging people to wear black on Fridays to mourn the 42 million unborn children who were killed with government permission this year throughout the world. Grieving is a way of showing the value of people who have been hurt by an injustice, showing love. Sometimes our grief is mixed with some uncertainty. Part of it is, can I handle this? I don't know if I can handle this. Some of it is, I'm afraid God is being unjust. In those kind of situations, we can still show grief and call out to God, how long, God, how long? We see that in Psalm 13 with don't know all that was going on in David's life at the time he wrote that psalm. There may have been some physical sickness. There may have been some interrelational conflict. He says, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long will I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long will my enemy be exalted over me? He cries out to the Lord in his grief. And that it's an example. The Bible, God gives us that as an example of how we can pray to God. We've already seen just last week what did Jesus do? He was just grieved at the brokenness of sin as he came down from the mountain. He says, "How long will I be with you? How long will I suffer with you and bear you up?" In Revelation 6, we have the martyrs calling out from under the altar, how long O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood? These prayers are an example for us. It's appropriate to grieve and ask God, how long? We also see, in addition to the response of grief, there is an embracing of suffering. Jesus, by making this prophecy of his death, was embracing the fact that he was going to suffer unjustly, and that he was okay. You know, he was okay with it. He was expecting this, and he was going to endure it. Why? Why did he endure suffering? It was to deliver helpless victims, to suffer instead of other people. We saw back in Matthew 15, God issued commands like, honor your father and mother, and whoever breaks these commands shall die the death. But Jesus never broke a single law, of God's law or of man's law. Never did anything wrong. It was not just for him to be killed. He did not deserve death. He died in order to save sinners. He offered his life up to pay the price of sin in the place of sinners who would otherwise die and go to hell. He accepted injustice in order to deliver us. Our world today is so messed up by sin and injustice, disregard for God's wisdom. We all end up suffering from someone else's foolishness from time to time. Are there any ways that we could purposefully, like Christ, purposefully take on suffering in order to purposefully lift a burden off of another person in the manner that Jesus did as he approached the injustice of his death? Paul said, bear ye one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. There is a place for embracing suffering in order to save someone else from that suffering. I'll work on that some more as we go down the line further. But moving on from this snapshot here, where Jesus delivers the second prophecy of his death, we have another scenario that starts at verse 24. As they came into Capernaum, the two drachma tax collectors approached Peter and said, y'all's teacher, doesn't he fulfill the two drachma ordinance? Now, Matthew is the only gospel writer who records this instance, and I would guess it's because Matthew was a sort of tax collector himself by profession. So this was interesting to him professionally. The word here in Greek for the payment that is asked for is literally the two drachma. Drachmas were a silver coin from Greece that was roughly equivalent to the Roman denarius, and it was worth a quarter to a half of a day's wages. And four of these drachma coins would equal one Jewish shekel. So we got a couple of different nationalities' currencies flowing through here, drachmas and shekels. The two drachma payment, the New King James translates it as a temple tax, and that's an accurate way to interpret that. It wasn't a civil tax imposed by the Roman government. That would be paid with a Roman coin that had the Caesar's face on it, like they talk about in Matthew 22. This is a different kind of tax. It was part of the Jewish tithes and offering system. And as a result, it actually had to be paid in Jewish shekels. And so what was in, the Greek and Roman currency that was standardly used in trade had to get changed out for this distinctly Jewish coin minted in the temple in order to pay this particular donation or tribute. Exodus 30, chapter 30, verse 11, introduces this part of the tithe and offering system of the Jews. If you'd like to, please turn in your Bibles, keep your thumb in Matthew 17, but you can turn over to Exodus 30. I'm going to kind of read an extended passage from there. Exodus 30, starting at verse 11. The Lord also spoke to Moses, saying, "When you take a census of the sons of Israel to number them, then each one of them shall give a ransom for himself to the Lord when you number them, so that there will be no plague among them when you number them. This is what everyone who is numbered shall give: half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary," that would be same as 2 drachmas, "half a shekel is a contribution to the Lord. Everyone who is numbered from 20 years and over shall give this contribution to the Lord. The rich shall not pay more, the poor shall not pay less than a half shekel when you give the contribution to the Lord to make atonement for yourselves. You shall take the atonement money from the sins of Israel and shall give it for the service of the tent of meeting, that it may be a memorial for the sons of Israel before the Lord to make atonement for yourselves." So it's a memorial offering that has these overtones of atonement that go along with it. We see this come up again in 2 Chronicles 24 when King Joash used this type of a donation system to underwrite the restoration of the temple after wicked Queen Athaliah had destroyed the temple, had gutted it to put stuff in her pagan temples. And then later on, a similar thing happens in Nehemiah chapter 10, where the Jews return from captivity in Babylon. They're wanting to rebuild the temple, and so they develop a temple fund, and Nehemiah has them all give. At that time, they gave a third of a didrachma. But kind of a similar concept. It was a special offering that would help with the temple. And whenever I'm looking at Jewish customs, I always go to John Gill's commentary, because he's such an expert on the Jewish customs. He says, "In the process of time from these instances and examples, it became a fixed thing that every year half a shekel should be paid by every Israelite, except women, children, and servants, towards defraying the necessary charges of the temple service." And so there's a whole tract of the Jewish Mishnah called the Shekelim, in which an account is given of the persons who are obliged to pay this money and the time and manner of collecting it and for what uses it could be put. On the 15th day of the month of Adar, the collectors would sit in every province or city, and they were supposed to mildly ask everyone to give this donation. He that gives to them, they receive it of him, and he that does not give, they do not oblige him to give. Then on the 25th of the month, they sit in the sanctuary and accept collections, and from there on, they urge people who won't give until they do give, basically. So it wasn't a compulsory tax. It wasn't by the Roman government. There was a social pressure, and it was considered a good and religious and helpful thing to do, to give this donation. It went towards the expenses of maintaining the temple. A.T. Robertson, in his Harmony of the Gospels, has charted out the timeline of Jesus' ministry, and he said the month of Adar would have been 6 months ago from the time that Jesus re-entered Capernaum from some Caesarea Philippi. So Jesus has been out and about. He wasn't there at the normal collection time for this donation. And so when he comes back into town, well, the tax collector shows up and says, "Hey, you guys going to give or not? You're 6 months overdue." They ask Peter. Nobody knows for sure why they asked Peter instead of Jesus. Maybe Jesus was staying at Peter's house, and so the tax collector was just coming to assess everybody in the house. But But there's some social pressure behind this question, the Greek grammar behind it, that can't really be translated into English, indicates that this tax collector is expecting Peter to say yes. He does pay the tax, doesn't he? And I expect you to say yes now. And Peter does give the anticipated answer. Of course, my teacher will pay it. Maybe it's because he had seen Jesus pay it in years past, and so he knew, oh, this is something Jesus does. And then in verse 25, when Peter enters into the house, Jesus gets in front of him and says, "What do you think, Simon? The kings of the earth, from whom do they collect income tax or property tax? From their children or from the others?" And Peter says to him, "From the others." Jesus says, "So indeed the sons are free." Jesus sees that this is a ripe time to teach Peter another spiritual lesson. And so he prevents, which means to get in front of, anticipates, and speaks out before Peter could say anything, gets in front of Peter and says, calls him by the name the tax collector probably used, Simon. That was his given name. That was his legal name, rather than the nickname Peter that Jesus had given him. And he asks this question about mill levies or customs, duties, tolls, tributes, taxes, whatever you've got in your translation there. Do kings tax their own kids? He asks. This Greek word for strangers or others is often used to indicate a foreigner, somebody that's an outsider. They're not family members. So they'd never be used of a family member. Now, in our culture, we might look at this question. We might want to answer this question differently in our American culture, because our country is oriented towards being extra nice towards immigrants and treating everybody fairly, exactly the same. But in Jesus' day, the Roman Empire thought the other way around. Romans thought that they were the greatest in the world. They conquered all these other nations, and so all the other nations owed it to them to pay taxes. And so many Romans just, lived off of the taxes from these other conquered nations. So it was just the expectation that if you're not a Roman, you're a foreigner, you pay taxes. And that goes to, pay for the entertainment and parties and government and all that the Romans do. Here, Jesus, as the Son of God, is claiming exemption from the temple tax, because royal families don't pay taxes. You get tribute from foreigners, aliens, subjects. He says sons are free. They're exempt. They're not bound by an obligation. And in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, this word is, and in most of the references in the New Testament, this word is used exclusively to denote people who are not slaves. So while Jesus is going to pay the tribute, he's impressing on his followers that paying this tax is not a denial of his kingly messiahship. The temple is his own father's house. He said that in Luke 2. Remember, he said, "My father's house," to his mom. And in Malachi, the prophet Malachi, the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come into his temple. It's his temple. He doesn't have to pay taxes because it's his temple. Other people should be paying the taxes for his temple. He's God. But he says in verse 27, "In order that we might not scandalize them, go to the lake, cast a hook, pull up the first fish that comes up, and after you open its mouth, you'll find a shekel. And once you get this, make a donation to them for me and you." Jesus does not want to create a scandal, something that would trip people up. These tax collectors were just doing their job. They're like the bell ringers at the Salvation Army, You go by, when I walk by those bell ringers, step out of Walmart and there's the bell ringer, I always feel like I should apologize and say, "Well, yeah, I wasn't planning to give anything today. But the bell ringers don't care. They're just ringing the bell and taking collections, and, you know, they can't absolve you for not giving or anything. And that's, you know, Jesus, you know, was recognizing there's no point in me trying to explain this to a tax collector that I don't deserve to pay. You know, we're not going to create a scandal here. Let's just give it to them. Not make a big deal of this. What's worse, Jesus' refusal to chip into the fund could cause ignorant people to think that he was being irreverent towards God and the holy things. He doesn't want to create the impression that he despises the temple and the worship of God. That would be a stumbling block. So the problem is Jesus doesn't have the money. Perhaps the money bag that Judas carried had gone strangely empty. Or perhaps Jesus didn't think it was appropriate to reallocate designated donations for his food. I don't know. For whatever reason, he solves the problem miraculously with this money in the fish's mouth. The piece of money that would be found in the fish was also a silver coin, but a bigger one called a statera in Greek. And it was equal in value to 4 drachmas, or 1 whole Jewish shekel. So ironically, you know, Jesus' own creation gives him money so that he can pay the tax for his own temple. And I was struck by a couple of comments that Matthew Henry made about this. He said, you know, Jesus could easily have commanded a whole bag of money. I mean, why not? Why not have the fish just drag up a whole bag of coins? You know, this would be make life a lot easier. But he only needed the 1 coin that day. That's all he needed, and so that's all he used his power to get. And I think in that we can learn a lesson to be content when we have enough for our present condition, our present occasions. Furthermore, you know, Jesus could have done the magician's trick and, oh, Peter, what's that in your ear? Oh, look, there's a shekel. He could have. I mean, it would have been a lot more convenient, wouldn't it? Okay, Peter, yeah, and take this on up to and pay this. But instead, what does he do? He says, Peter, go back to work. You're a fisherman. You're being asked to pay a tax. Go back to the lake, put in your fishing hook, and work for the day. Get this in a legitimate way. We're not gonna pull money out of thin air. I'm gonna send you to work for it. Matthew Henry's comment on this was, even in miracles, Jesus would use means to encourage industry and endeavor. This is to teach us diligence and employment. The employment that we're called to and called in. He says, do we expect that Christ should give to us? Then let us be ready to work for him. Good point. So the one principle that I saw as I initially read these two stories, I was like, what on, you know, how on earth am I? They're both too short to do a whole sermon on. Is there any common theme I can find between these two stories of Jesus' prophecy and of this coin in the fish's mouth? And the common thread that I saw was responding to injustice. We looked at the injustice of a death that was not deserved, and the injustice of a tax that was not properly levied. But we looked at grief as a Christian response to injustice. Of course, there are non-Christian ways of expressing grief that I'm not including, don't have time to get into now. We don't mourn as the heathen do, as Paul said in 1 Thessalonians. But there is a place, an appropriate time to express grief as a Christian. But in addition to grief, we have to choose to either suffer or resist injustice. These two stories don't touch on the Christian, the possibility of resistance to injustice. That principle is illustrated in other places, like where Jesus instructed his disciples to carry a couple of swords. You know, that's a symbol of resistance to injustice. Paul's use of his legal rights as a Roman citizen to protect himself from being killed by mobs in Jerusalem. He said, "No, I'm not going to go to Jerusalem to be tried. I'm a Roman citizen. You try me here," in Caesarea. There's a place to resist and to use the authority and the means that God has given you to stop an injustice from happening. Since that wasn't in these stories and these snapshots of Jesus' life, I want to focus more on these two situations when it was not time to resist, where it was good and right to choose to suffer an injustice. In the case of Jesus' crucifixion, he willingly suffered the injustice of a criminal death and of God's wrath against him because he was doing that to save us from having to die ourselves. And as Christians, sometimes Christians do encounter situations where we could literally lay down our life to save another person's life. My wife was reading a blog recently about a woman who had cancer and was pregnant, and the only treatment that would be effective against the cancer would kill the baby. According to my understanding of the assessment of that situation, and so she chose to die of the cancer rather than abort her baby. There are opportunities where we could actually lay down our life to save another one. An acquaintance of mine by the name of John was sitting in a church in Kabul, Afghanistan, probably 15, 20 years ago, and middle of a worship service, grenade comes in through the window, hits the floor, and he was not able to get over to the grenade, so he decided to just spread himself over his wife's body, and the grenade exploded, and he got shrapnel in him and severe burns, but survived. But there are times when we can give our life for another person to save a life. And the motivation is love. Suffer out of love for someone else. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friend. But for most of us, we're not going to have that dramatic an opportunity to show love. For most of us, it'll be in little things where we could choose to suffer an injustice, an insult, or whatever, and I'm reminded of a story my dad tells about his childhood, where one of his brothers or sisters had gotten their clothes really dirty and then left them in the middle of the living room, and somewhere in the wrong place anyway, not where it should have been, and so his dad discovered these filthy clothes and said, somebody needs to be disciplined for this. But he didn't know, grandpa didn't know who it was. So he called my dad and his brothers and sisters all together, lined them all up with these clothes, and he said, "Well, Philip, are these your clothes? Kenny, are these your clothes? Patty, are these your clothes?" Went down the line, nobody would say it was theirs. Because they knew that whoever fessed up was going to get a whooping. And so Grandpa goes down the line again. "Philip, are these your clothes?" He's getting more and more steamed. And whoever the culprit was not going to say what it was. And meanwhile, my dad's friends arrived in the front lawn. You could see them out there. They're ready to go fishing. Dad wanted to go fishing with them. And so finally he just said, he decided he was going to claim that he did it and take the spanking himself in order to just help everybody move on. of course, I'm not saying we should lie or foster codependent relationships or anything like that, but you get the idea that there are times we can suffer for somebody else as a Christian to show love and to alleviate their suffering. Other times, we may choose to suffer just because it's not something that's worth fighting for. I think that was the case of the temple tax. It wasn't worth making a big deal over this one. This was an offense that could just be passed over. Any problems that would have resulted from Jesus asserting his tax exemption would have outweighed any financial businesses and any financial benefit from being down a couple of drachmas. So, despite the injustice of it, there are even good reasons to just go ahead and go with it, because it would be a way for Jesus to identify with mankind, just as he did that in his baptism. Accept baptism, even though it wasn't something that he needed. It was a way he had to identify with us sinful humans and pay an atonement price, even though he had no sins to atone for. It became him to fulfill all righteousness. And it sets an example. If Jesus was willing to do it, we can be willing to pay taxes that we're just not so sure about how this money is going to get spent. It shows honor. When people whom God has given a place of authority, you know, honoring them even when we're not so sure they're doing everything exactly the right way. Contributing to the support of public worship, that's a good and honorable thing, even if it's been corrupt like it was in Jesus' day. There are some things, of course, you know, again, there's a limit to making concessions. We must never decline our duty. If it's our duty given us by God, we should never decline that for fear of giving offense. There were things that Jesus did that were offensive, that in-your-face kind of miracles and teaching that needed to be done. So there's a limit to, you know, how much we should make concessions. But we must sometimes deny ourselves things that are in our interest rather than give offense. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 8, you know, if my brother is offended by food, then I won't eat meat again. When people were getting upset at each other in the church of Corinth, suing each other, the Apostle Paul said, wouldn't it be better to just suck it up if you've been wronged? Why not just be defrauded? Later on, the Apostle Peter wrote to Christians that were being persecuted, and he said, if it's God's will for you to suffer, it's okay for you to suffer for doing right. Kind of paraphrasing that, but it's okay to suffer for doing what's right. Just don't suffer for being a wrongdoer. So even as we show grief and as we choose to suffer or resist injustice, depending on God's calling, there's one more response that Christians are called to exhibit, and I want to close with this one. That's faith. Faith that God's going to work it out. In this temple tax scenario, Peter shows faith in Jesus, that Jesus has the knowledge and power to oversee the entire sequence of events necessary for this miraculous provision in the fish. I mean, someone's going to have to lose a shekel in the lake. Somebody, you know, just the right denomination of coin, just the right time. There's got to be a fish that catches this thing in its mouth without swallowing it and without spitting it back out. And that's going to be the first fish that comes by on his hook. Peter had to trust that Jesus had the power to oversee, make sure all this was going to happen. But that is how tightly God's providence works. That's how tightly God's providence works. This is the God that we worship. He's amazing. He's worthy of our trust when we need to depend upon him to take care of us. Later on, Peter would write that Jesus gave us an example of trusting God during suffering. When he suffered, He made no threats, 1 Peter 2. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. When he suffered, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. There's our example. As the Christmas carol said, God is not dead, nor does he sleep. The wrong will fail, the right prevail. With peace on earth, goodwill to men. That is a way we can express our faith. God, you're going to work all this out. So brothers and sisters, let's follow the example of Christ and of his apostles by suffering injustice redemptively, grieving appropriately, with faith in God to work it all out for good.